Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Now, back to America This Week, live with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
Welcome back. I'm Carrie Weber. I'm here with Father Matt Malone and Father Eric Sundrup. And we are talking about the news at the intersection of the church and the world, as we do each week here on America This Week. And some of that news this week is featured on our website. It's about Richard Simmons, as we were talking about earlier before the break. And to clarify, the podcast is called Missing Richard Simmons, and the producer is Dan Taberski. And it has become a very popular and somewhat controversial podcast, because some people feel like Richard Simmons should just have the right to be left alone now. And our writer, Father Jim McDermott, in his article, Jesus Left Us and So Did Richard Simmons, We Better Get Used to It, makes the bold comparison between, and not quite, as this is let's preface this.
It's not a one-to-one.
Not a direct comparison. There's this sense of when the when Jesus ascended after the resurrection, the apostles probably were like, where did you go? Why did you leave us? What's going on? And resisted a little bit. And we don't get a lot of that in the Gospels. And he's saying that we have to kind of be prepared to let go when people need to kind of go do their own thing. And that maybe this is, in a very, very small way, not saying that Richard Simmons is Jesus, let's clarify, but in a very small way, you know, kind of the attitude that, like, Richard Simmons has been, you know, a leader and someone that has been very much admired for a lot of people in a certain fitness community, that he also has the right to kind of lead his private life and remove himself from the public eye.
Right. In fact, Father Jim writes in this piece, it might seem strange to compare the sudden reclusiveness of a hyperactive fitness guru with the ascension of our Lord and Savior. And objectively, it does seem strange.
Yeah, it doesn't just seem that way. It actually is.
But listening to Taberski, I can't help think this is what any actual ascension must have been like. People, despite all their best instincts, not being able to let go. We just need a little more time. I still have so many questions. I want you to stay with me forever. And Jesus finally having to cut it off. I was here to get you started. You have all that you need within you. Now grow up and get to it. I think that that's actually, there's something really to that, you know, because what Father Jim is touching on there is the act of trust that Jesus makes in us by virtue of his ascension, right? He is saying, I trust you. I walked with you. I shared this experience with you. You have shared in this experience in which I've lifted up the entire world through the cross and through my resurrection. And I now trust you to take this precious gift and carry it forward. And I'm sure Jesus was under no illusions that we were going to get that right all the time. But yeah, I mean, there's an element of trust in that. And I don't think we often think about, we're always talking about our faith and how important it is to trust in God, but we don't really talk a lot about how much God trusts us.
Yeah, and I think what I love about the piece is it pulls out that human aspect of that. Like, when you imagine these gospel scenes, and that's part of the Ignatian tradition, imagine this scene, you know, this scene from the gospel, and imagine what the human emotions that are built in there, right? The difficulty the disciples likely had with, whoa, he's going to trust us. I have a hard time imagining what that must have felt like. Okay, so next steps are?
Well, and I think some of our tendency to hold on and to lift up public figures like this, in a sense, are often our attempts to kind of replace what trust should be in Christ sometimes, and say, yeah, and say, well, no, I can't go on without Richard Simmons, but you can. And that's because Christ, although ascended, remains with us now and remains with Richard Simmons wherever he is.
I also think that it's related to something that we were talking about earlier. We were talking about former President Bush, you know, painting these portraits of these veterans. And, you know, people have a much more favorable view of George Bush now than they did when he was president, right? And the same is true with President Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter says, now everywhere I go, people wave at me and they're using all fingers. You know? I mean, there's a... our relationship to a person changes when it exists largely in memory, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, now that George W. isn't in our present in the dramatic and ever-present way that he was when he was president, and we have somebody new occupying that space in our imagination, our relationship with him changes, right? And there is a way in which that becomes a living memory that right. you carry forward. And the same is true with the memory of this, the church's memory of the resurrection. You know, there's this, Jesus literally says, do this in memory of me.
Right.
But he trusts us to be able to do that.
Right. And it's go and do it. It's not right. just like sit there and remember me.
Right.
It's like go out and actually act right. as though you remember that I was alive and among you. And
right.
Remain that way.
And there's an important part of the Eucharistic prayer that's called the anamnesis,
yep.
which is when we recall that memory and bring that past into the present. So we're not just trying to remember a historical fact. Right. We are, in fact, trying to make the past present in a dramatic way so that it may shape our future anew. And that's the role of memory. And it also explains why the church's experience of that memory has changed and evolved and been challenged and prospered and over the centuries, because it's a living memory. It's a living reality. Right.
Yeah.
He is risen. Well, I know it's still Lent. I'm not supposed to say that.
Wait for it.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, how we live out that memory in the church and in the world is a question that we have to constantly be asking ourselves. It's certainly one that we ask ourselves at America. We not only propose a way in which to do that, but we also report on how people are doing that. And so our guest for the second half of the broadcast is an important part of how one church, a local church, a parish in San Francisco, is bringing that memory to bear in the contemporary world.
Yeah, we're going to be talking momentarily with Sister Letitia Boards, who is a member of the Society of Helpers, which seems appropriate given her role at St. Agnes, which is setting itself up to help people who are in need, who are refugees and immigrants. They're setting up response teams. They're setting up info sessions for people in the parish to learn how to then go out and do and take that memory of Christ and take action, because we remember that role. So Sister Bordas, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
I wonder if we could start by talking a little bit about your experience in the early 80s and with many political refugees then in the Bay Area.
Yes, because that's very important in order to understand the reawakening of the sanctuary movement today. In the 80s, of course, the wars were going on in Central America. They were civil wars in Guatemala, in El Salvador, Honduras, and more refugees were coming in, especially into the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area. And at that time, they were, of course, refugees, not immigrants. Refugees are those who escape from violence in a war situation that is recognized as a war situation. Now we're facing what we call undocumented immigrants, who also come from different kind of war situations. But at that time, we had so many refugees coming in, and they were seeking asylum because of the persecution going on in their country. Many of them had been severely tortured, lost members of their families. And I think the sanctuary movement really began with Presbyterian minister Reverend John Fife in Tucson, Arizona, at the Southside Presbyterian Church there. Of course, Tucson is near the desert, and they were aware of how many refugees coming through. And like back in 1984, they found 13 bodies in the desert, and that really inspired them to do something in their congregation. And from there, the movement spread. And here in the Bay Area, we were already organized regarding Central America. The diocese had a Latin American task force, and Catholic Charities began a Central American refugee organizing project. And as the refugees arrived, we thought it was very, very important to educate the community about the reality of the countries from which they were coming, because people really did not know what was going on in Central America. They were really not aware of the role that the United States was playing in the wars there, in the billions of dollars that were being sent to those countries. So what was organized at that time, which was a wonderful organizing tool, was the House meeting, and that was based on the Cesar Chavez organizing back in the 70s at the time of the boycotts and all. And so we would ask someone to host a House meeting, invite a few neighbors, and at that meeting we would bring one of the refugees, and the refugees would tell his or her story of what had happened in his or her country there. And one thing that's important is that you can argue forever with someone who has different ideas or a different philosophy, but no one can deny another person's story. That story belongs to the person, and you can't say to that person, no, that's not real, that did not happen to you. So in hearing those stories, the hearts of people were really changed. And, of course, it was used as an organizing tool. So at the end of the meeting, after people had heard the story and the organizer gave a bit of background as to the facts, the political facts in those countries, people were invited to commit themselves in some way. They could visit their representative, they could write letters, or what they could do would be to open their homes to refugees who were seeking asylum. There were just many different ways that they could become organized. And from that, some communities decided to become sanctuary parishes, sanctuary communities. And, you know, when we say sanctuary, people often think, oh, that means I have to open my house, I have to bring in somebody I don't know, who's going to happen. There are many, many different ways of participating in sanctuary.
Sister Letitia.
It was, yes, I'm sorry, I'm going on.
No. It's a very good story. You're telling a good story. One of the questions I have, you were talking about how important that role of someone telling their story. In the article, it sounds like that's the similar thing that you're using now when we do sanctuary. The sanctuary community at St. Agnes, you're letting people tell stories. Can you tell us a little bit about how they're telling their stories now?
Well, what is happening right now at St. Agnes, of course, now, since I should say from 2014, there was a revival kind of a sanctuary, although it had never really died in the United States. You had the East Bay Sanctuary, the South Bay Sanctuary still going on. But St. Agnes had never been part of the sanctuary movement. And now they are. And St. Agnes Church declared sanctuary the day before the inauguration. And they have... of course, at St. Agnes Parish also has the St. Agnes of the Ignatian Spiritual Life Center. And the director there, Natalie Terry, was very much interested when I approached her, really, to speaking with Father Allender, the pastor, and the staff, and seeing if the parish would want to respond to that invitation to become sanctuary. And they did. And it's the, I believe, it's the first Jesuit parish in the country to proclaim sanctuary, if I'm not mistaken.
Indeed, it is, sister.
It is.
And
I think it is.
Which is an impressive step forward in and of itself. What?
So now it is getting organized. For instance, there is a sanctuary committee, and that committee will be made up of people that will strategize more on how to lead the parish in strategizing and living out the sanctuary as a community. Already an accompaniment team has been formed, the Rapid Response Network has been formed, and a parish education initiative to educate, organize events, lead information sessions is in the process of being formed. I mean, this is the end of March, and this was just inaugurated in January.
Wow.
So we are still at a starting point. But I must say, the response has been fantastic. When there was the first meeting in inviting people to come to a rapid response.
What does a rapid response mean? Someone that doesn't know what that is.
Okay, so the Rapid Response Network has been prepared in order to respond when ICE is launching
Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. Mm-hmm.
That's right, exactly. It has been really well organized in the San Francisco Bay Area. There's a Rapid Response Action Network that has a resist line that people can call for an action alert. There is a San Francisco number as well. So people are trained in order to be witnesses. So when someone is aware that a raid is going on or someone is being picked up on the street, they call this number and they alert those people who have been trained to go and witness what is taking place, to take the information and to notify the legal offices that could be of assistance to the person who has been picked up.
Right.
Also, if possible, to notify the family of the person who has been picked up.
Now, sister, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how you expected the parishioners to react when you proposed that the parish become more involved in these issues, and then how, in fact, they did respond. Was it an enthusiastic response? Were people hesitant?
Well, at the first meeting that was called, in order to let people know about the Rapid Response Network, what that would look like, they expected maybe 30 people to come, and 365 people came.
Wow.
That's
so that
you're gonna need a much bigger room then.
Well, yes, they had to move from the room to the church itself for that meeting. And the second meeting that they had, what I want to say is that St. Agnes is not isolated in this. And what is great about what is going on right now in the new kind of sanctuary that we see is that all the organizations are working together. So St. Agnes is working very closely with other organizations that are involved, also with the Archdiocesan office, and at the meeting that they had, one of the persons from the Archdiocese brought a refugee to tell his story to the people there, similar to what we used to do.
Right, it echoes that. And allows people to really see the person.
To listen to the story, to see the person, and to know the agony. And one thing that I want to mention, too, not everybody is called to a rapid response, but I'd like to talk about the accompaniment team, because that's something almost anyone can offer to do. We have the Sanctuary Committee, Accompaniment Team, Rapid Response Network, Parish Education Initiative. But accompaniment team, you can sign up to say, yes, I would be willing to take this undocumented immigrant to the clinic because she's afraid to go. She's afraid she will be picked up on the way and she has to take the bus. I'll be happy to accompany her. She's afraid to meet her children after school, afraid that ICE is hanging around the schools. Yes, I can go with her maybe once a week where she goes to pick up her children. There are a number of ways that people can accompany. It's not only opening your home to somebody who really needs a place to stay, but accompanying them to doctor's visits, also accompanying them to court. For example, if an undocumented person got a ticket for going through a red light or not being at a stop sign, they are afraid to appear in court. And what has happened right now in the Bay Area is that ICE has been hanging around the courts. They are outside to see who comes out. And therefore, people are afraid to go, or if they have a hearing, they are afraid to report to their hearing. So the accompaniment team, people would be willing to assist, to be there as witnesses, and so it's offering really a very different kind of protection.
And that type of accompaniment, that doesn't require any legal expertise. That's just to be there as a support, correct?
Exactly. So you don't need to go through a lot of training for that. Like the rapid response, they do ask that you go through a training to know exactly what you ought to do, to cooperate with the law, not to break the law in
right.
what you are doing as
and
a witness.
So what does that look like, sister?
The rapid response network?
In a specific way. If you got a phone call, what would you do?
Okay, if I had a phone call, okay, I would call the telephone number. There is one for San Francisco, and to let them know where this is happening. Say someone calls me and says this is happening. I would call the Rapid Response Action Network, and I myself would get there right away. Now, the Rapid Response Network, that phone call we call, they get in touch with the different the people who have offered legal assistance. So my responsibility would be to try to get there as soon as possible and to record what I see as a witness.
To be an observer,
a witness, to gather as much information as you can in order to communicate that information. Because if that person is held somewhere, we hope to get legal assistance for that person as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, the story is how St. Agnes Church became the first Jesuit parish in America to declare itself a sanctuary. And you can find that reported by Kaya Oakes at americamagazine.org. Sister Letitia Boards, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Okay. God bless you and your ministry.
Thank you.
That's really a remarkable story. I mean, there are, you know, welcoming the stranger is, of course, a biblical mandate, and, you know, treating people with respect and respecting their human dignity is an essential element of Catholic social teaching. Always, you know, always a question, how does the church put its money where its mouth is? And that's St. Agnes's answer.
Yeah, it's...
And to her point, you know, it doesn't have to be everybody's answer, but it's theirs.
Right. And also there's multiple ways in which you can support and accompany somebody. Some more, I don't know, maybe more... I want to say radical, but I don't want to say radical, right? Because I think that just quietly accompanying somebody is also a radical act. So all across the board, I feel like there's that radical nature of the gospel that's lived out in just different ways.
The accompanying someone, when I worked in Michigan in Ann Arbor, and we had Hispanic ministry there was a team, and our director of Hispanic ministry would frequently accompany people to court hearings and other things, because it's a moment of such fear and insecurity, and to have someone there that you trust that is by your side, and they don't have to be a lawyer, they don't have to say anything, but you know you have someone from a community that cares and is with you and you know values your dignity as a person, it's still a very difficult situation, but it changes so much. And so many members of the community there would talk about how important that is to them.
About 10 days ago, we had here in New York the papal nuncio, or ambassador, to the United States, Archbishop Christophe Pierre, who's been in the job close to a year now. And I interviewed him at the New York Athletic Club in front of an audience of our readers. And I couldn't think of a better ambassador for Francis than this man. He seemed to be like channeling. He seems to share a brain with the Pope. But this is what he was talking about. He was talking about getting out into the streets. You know, if there's something that is really sui generis in a way about the proclamation and witness of Francis, it is the fierce urgency that he sees in the gospel mandate. You know, this is something that is radically now. You have to get out of the street. You have to reach out. You have to touch people. You have to meet them where they are. You have to act now. And this is, you know, St. Agnes is the way that they're doing it, that they're following that gospel mandate to which Francis is bearing witness. But to your point, Carrie, there are a number of different ways to do that.
Right. And the thing that I find really beautiful about it is that it happens as a community, and communities help us not to sort of delay in responding to that urgency. We call each other sort of out of ourselves, out into being more active members of our parish communities, our church communities, our cities and towns, in a way that I think if we all kind of just thought, you know, I really should be living out this gospel, but Netflix. So, like, if you're part of a community, you're reminded and you're offered those opportunities. Like, I don't have to go home and come up with a way to respond to this. My community, as a faith community, presents this to us, right? My parish community in New Jersey is co-sponsoring a refugee family with another parish in the area, and people are responding by, you know, signing up for donating furniture, donating books, driving people to doctor's appointments, all of those things that, if I tried to do them alone, could be very overwhelming, but in the context of community allows us to live it so much more fully.
And that's a very interesting point, because a community, an ecclesial community or a religious community, or sometimes your family, sometimes your friends, but a community not only nourishes you and not only provides you with spiritual succor, but it holds you accountable.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And that's an important part of our life together as a church, is supporting one another, nurturing one another, but also holding each other accountable and saying, "Hey, my friend, my brother, my sister, how are you actually living out this gospel?"
Right. Mandate? It's that mercy as an invitation. That mercy as this idea of come join us, come join me. We are not alone in this at all. And when we work together in the name of mercy, we do so much more.
It ties even earlier, as we were talking climate change, or we were talking the importance of, in these sort of intractable debates sometimes, of seeing other people, hearing their stories, and having that call us to having that call something out of it, holding us accountable as we get to know these other people that are affected in all of these very different ways that we might not pay attention to, or we might be numbed to in other circumstances, but a community can pull that out of you.
And yeah, people see things in you that you might not see in yourself, or trust you in ways you don't trust yourself, and say, look, you have these skills, you have these talents, come on, use them for the greater good.
Yeah, and it seems to me that that's the theme that's been running through all of our stories today, which is, what is the relationship between the individual and the community, the relationship between the one and the many, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about that at the top of the hour when we were talking about, you know, how do we respond as a community and as individuals to the crisis of climate change. And, you know, we talked about George Bush finding his way and making sense of his actions as an individual within a very much larger community, you know, through his art. And, I mean, even Richard Simmons, right? Maybe he just discovered that he belonged to a community and didn't even know it. and what it means when somebody exits the community. What does that mean to the community? What does that mean to the individual? And of course, you know, Sister described this community at St. Agnes in the Haight-Ashbury, and how it has been dramatically changed by listening to the stories of individuals. That is the church at work, and it's a beautiful thing.
Well done. That was,
you think so?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a nice little thesis.
Okay.
I'm impressed.
Yeah. Thank God I had that coffee before I came in here.
No, I think that's, I mean, that's a question that all of us have to ask kind of in our daily lives all the time. You know, what am I doing for others? What am I doing for my relationship with God? And how are these things affecting one another? Mm.
Well, I know one thing that people could do. They could subscribe to American
I
Magazine.
I thought that might be where you were headed with this.
Saw that coming.
Join our community.
Join the conversation, right? And that's a, I'm kidding. Though, if you'd like I'm about to tell you how. But that's important because we understand ourselves as a community.
Right, exactly.
A community of writers and of readers, and most importantly, of disciples. So you've been listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. And you can follow up on all of these stories and read more at americamagazine.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. And to subscribe to America Magazine, call 1-800-627-9533. That's 1-800-627-9533 for a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. For Carrie Weber and Father Eric Sundrup, I'm Matt Malone. Thank you and good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.